May the words of my mouth and thoughts of my heart be acceptable before you, O God, my rock and my redeemer. Shalom all and welcome. I am your host, Ariel Bartzadok. You find me online at koshertorah.com. I've titled this course, An Orthodox Rabbi Reads the Christian Bible. My purpose and intent in teaching this course is simple. I want to be able to explain why Torah Judaism and Torah faithful Jews do not and will not accept or embrace the teachings of the Christian religion. I have no intentions or desires in this course to attack the religion of Christianity. I am not here to challenge or critique those who embrace the Christian faith. I am not here to talk about Christianity at all. Even though due to the nature of this material, I am sure that I will not be able to avoid the topic entirely. Nevertheless, I am here to look at the Christian Bible from an entirely Torah point of view. I begin with certain premises. I do not deny the existence of an historical Yeshu, being called Yeshua or what. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be the Messiah of Israel. For Torah faithful Jews, Yeshu was not, is not, and can never be God, or even a son of God, any more than any other human being of flesh and blood. For the record, the historical Yeshu was born, lived as, and died as a Jew. He and his original followers were all Jews, who like him were born, lived as, and died as Jews. Absolutely none of them were Christians in any sense of the word. We Torah faithful Jews follow the same religion that Yeshu himself practiced. We pray to the same Heavenly Father. We live by the same Torah, mitzvot, and ma'asim, tovim. Yeshu was not a Christian, and neither are we. Yeshu's original followers were all Torah observant Jews, as was he. As Jews educated in Torah, drenched in its teachings, and from what can be seen, knowing no other spiritual path, I must logically conclude that the original writings of Yeshu's original followers were all Jewish writings, and therefore well within my domain as a Torah observant rabbi to read them and understand them as would one rabbi to another. I therefore begin with the proposition that anything found in the Christian Bible attributed to any of his Jewish authors that does not agree with Torah Judaism must not have been written by such an author, and is therefore subject to suspicion and must be critically analyzed. And that is what I am here to do. Like many Torah sages before me, I do not accept Talmudic Midrash about Yeshu at face value. Those teachings were meant to be polemic, not historical. Therefore, they will not be part of our discussions. Now, I've been led to perform this work because of the experiences of my personal life. As a teenager, I was victimized by a terrible evangelical group in my hometown on Long Island. This group was led by an evil, lying, deceitful individual who turned out to also be a pedophile. I'm thankful that I was able to escape being victimized in that way. Nevertheless, this individual sought to clandestinely place his minions in Orthodox yeshivot in Israel to get them to learn about Judaism, with the attempt to make it easier for them to persuade Jews to convert and to join their fold. I fought long and hard against this group, and I'm proud of my contribution in thwarting their efforts. It was through them and because of them that I became exposed to Christianity, and I therefore devoted the last 40 years of my life to study and investigation to discover whatever the truth that is still out there to be discovered. And now, after 40 years, I feel confident and ready to share my insights and discoveries with you. So again, I reiterate, I am not here to attack our God-fearing, Bible-believing Christian neighbors. I hold them in the highest esteem and respect. I'm here to explain to you, to them, and all willing to listen, what we Torah faithful Jews see when we read the Christian Bible, and why we see what we do. And now, let us proceed with tonight's lesson. This is lesson 22 in this series, and we are almost finished now with the book of Matthew. We are in the text of Matthew, in the middle of the story of what's called the Passions of Yeshu. His arrest, his beatings and torture, his crucifixion, and then, of course, the stories about his resurrection. Now, I've long shared with you ideas and beliefs which are rather very ancient, that the crucifixion in and of itself was a hoax, a setup. These teachings that I share with you are not modern. They're not new at all. Indeed, They date back, from what I understand, to the 2nd century. In accordance to research that I have done, I have found that there was a certain teacher, I believe in Egypt, by the name of Basilides, who either claimed to be or is known to be a student of none other than our Matthew. He claims that indeed Yeshu did not die on the cross. From what I understand, and this I'm taking right from Wikipedia, he says, speaking of Yeshu, he did not himself suffer death, but Simon, a certain man of Cyrene, being compelled, bore the cross in his stead, so that this latter, being transfigured by him, that he might be thought to be Jesus, was crucified, though ignorance and error, while Jesus himself received the form of Simon, and, standing by, laughed at them. For since he was an incorporeal power, and the nous, the mind of the unborn father, he transfigured himself as he pleased, and thus ascended to him who sent him, deriding them, inasmuch as he could not be laid hold of, and was invisible to all. Well, whether or not that is true or false is irrelevant to our learning, but we should know that such ideas existed a long time ago. And indeed, you will find the echoes of this even codified in the Quran itself. Remember, Muhammad learned most about Torah and Christianity from those local in Arabia. And I am becoming more and more convinced that the Jewish tribes in Arabia who Muhammad had exposure to were Ebionites, Nazareans, the original followers of Yeshu, yes, centuries later, because their teachings overlap to the point where they are identical. And Yeshu's followers, the original Birioni, were known troublemakers. They betrayed Jews in Judaism to the point where it led to the destruction of Jerusalem. They were the Birioni we read about in the Talmud and we discussed in previous classes. Muhammad himself was betrayed by many of these Jewish tribes. And if indeed these tribes were as Ebionite Nazareans, well, what could I say? It goes to show, in other words, that this group of individuals not only caused trouble for all of Jews in Israel, they also caused trouble for Arabs and Islam and Muslims. Because in all due respect, if you look at the history of Muhammad, whether or not you believe he spoke to God or not, he was really trying to do something good. I mean, to abolish idolatry, get people to believe in God, have a moral code, live a righteous life. I can't knock that. I really wish modern Muslims would get back to that original message and embrace the original Islam, but that's a story for politics and not for now. But anyway, to discuss the issue of Yeshu's crucifixion. Was it a hoax? Was it all some kind of a plan? We have discussed this in the past, and I want to share with you some interesting insights. And therefore, I'm going to again read to you in depth from a book called Holy Blood, Holy Grail, which came out in the 1980s, a very interesting, controversial topic that not only was Yeshu married to Mary Magdalene, again, something dating back to literature from the first century, nothing new under the sun there. However, it is alleged that Yeshu's bloodline continued and continues to this very day, where in which they have a secret society of power dealers throughout the world called the Priory of Zion, the Priory de Sion, and they are the true powers that be behind the world and the new world order and the like. And their purpose and intent is to put one of the bloodline descendants of Yeshua upon the throne of Israel, thus uniting all the world religions and the like. Okay, I mean, you know, as conspiracy theories go, this one I guess is as good as any of the others. Actually, this one's a real pip. I mean, you know, I've heard cult leaders talk about this. Dan Brown, if you remember the famous author, in his book, The Da Vinci Codes, based his work upon this idea. And yes, somebody here in text is commenting correctly. This is what their version of the, end quote, second coming is. Not that Yeshua is going to come back from heaven, but rather his great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandson is going to pop up and said, aha! Here I am, the bloodline of the house David, of the descendant of the royal, and therefore Israel has to accept me, the church has to accept me, by definition, Islam, and blah, blah, blah. Is there any truth to any of this conspiracy theories? Who knows? And frankly, who cares? But the ideas and the concepts that are brought down here in Holy Blood and Holy Grail are clearly and truly reminiscent of our Judaic understandings of the crucifixion. Before we get into the text, before we even read the end quote embellished stories, there are major questions that are brought down in this text, which I might add, are not original to this text. Most of the material here, in this, which I'm going to read to you, comes from a book today which no one can find anymore called The Jesus Scroll by Donovan Joyce. This is the book that claims that in the early 1960s at Masada, they found a scroll written by the head of the Masada rebels, who claims how he was the leader of the insurrection, and supposedly how he faked a crucifixion to make himself to be the supernatural Messiah. And here he is writing his, his will or his last words. And it was signed Yeshua, or if you will, Yehoshua HaGenesareti, which would translate as Jesus of Galilee. Is there any truth to the existence of such a scroll? Again, controversy and conspiracy theory. But the ideas and the beliefs, as outlined by Joyce and echoed here in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, in a section called The Priest King Who Never Ruled, I think are worthy of our consideration. And therefore, I want to read to you an in-depth section dealing with this even before we read the gospel account, because this, in my opinion, should set the stage for the questions that we truly need from a scholarly point of view to ask. Now remember, our Christian listeners, our Christian brothers and sisters, needless to say, are not going to listen to any of this, and that's fine. We're not here to change anybody's faith. If they want to believe that Jesus died for their sins and through the blood of the cross they are saved, God bless. If it makes you a better person, if it brings you closer to God and makes you righteous, then, in the words of James, Yeshua's blood brother, faith without works is dead, right? Go for it. God bless you. We are not here to argue doctrine, theology, or the like. That is a very Christian thing to do. It's not a Jewish thing to do. We're more concerned about your deeds, as I believe Yeshua himself taught throughout this course. So, in light of that, and any apologies that need to be to any Christian believers who might be offended by this material, let's read. I share with you again the words from the Holy Blood and Holy Grail. Quote, "Is there any evidence that Jesus did indeed survive the crucifixion, or that the crucifixion was in some way a fraud?" Hold on one second here. Just to let you know, there are different versions of the text. Therefore, I cannot give you a page number from which to read. This is a section called The Crucifixion in Detail, in the section called The Priest King Who Never Reigned, in the book Holy Blood, Holy Grail. So for those of you who want to acquire a copy, you can have this material before you. Getting back to the text. Given the portrait of him, I assume Yeshua, in the Gospels, It is inexplicable that Jesus was crucified at all. According to the Gospels, his enemies were the established Jewish interests in Jerusalem. But such enemies, if they in fact existed, could have stoned him to death of their own accord. I add, I'm not sure that's true, but... and on their own authority, without involving Rome in the matter. According to the Gospels, Jesus had no particular quarrel with Rome, and did not violate Roman law. And yet he was punished by the Romans in accordance with Roman law and Roman procedures. And he was punished by crucifixion, a penalty exclusively reserved for those guilty of crimes against the empire. If Jesus was indeed crucified, he cannot have been as apolitical as the Gospels depict him. On the contrary, he must have necessity have done something to provoke Roman as opposed to Jewish wrath. Whatever the trespasses for which Jesus was crucified, his apparent death on the cross is fraught with inconsistencies. There is quite simply no reason why this crucifixion, as the Gospels depict it, should have been fatal. The contention that it was warrants closer scrutiny. The Roman practice of crucifixion adhered to very precise procedures. After sentence, a victim would be flogged and consequently weakened by loss of blood. His outstretched arms would then be fastened, usually by thongs, but sometimes by nails, to a heavy wooden beam placed horizontally across his neck and shoulders. Bearing this beam, he would then be led to the place of execution. Here, with the victim hanging from it, the beam would be raised and attached to a vertical post or stake. Hanging thus from his hands, it would be impossible for the victim to breathe unless his feet were also fixed to the cross, thus enabling him to press down on them and relieve pressure on his chest. But despite the agony, a man suspended with his feet fixed, and especially a fit and healthy man, would usually survive for at least a day or two. Indeed, the victim often could take as much as a week to die from exhaustion, from thirst, or, if nails were used, from blood poisoning. The attenuated agony could be terminated more quickly by breaking the victim's legs or knees, which in the Gospels, Jesus' executioners are about to do before they are forestalled. Breaking of the legs or knees was not an additional sadistic torment. On the contrary, it was an act of mercy, a coup de grace, which caused a very rapid death. With nothing to support him, the pressure on the victim's chest would become intolerable, and he would quickly asphyxiate. Now, there is consensus among modern scholars that only the fourth gospel rests on an eyewitness account of the crucifixion. According to the fourth gospel, Jesus' feet were affixed to the cross, thus relieving the pressure on his chest muscles, and his legs were not broken. He should therefore, in theory at least, have survived a good day or two or three. And yet he is on the cross for no more than a few hours before being pronounced dead. In the Gospel of Mark, even Pilate is astonished by the rapidity with which the death occurs, Mark 15:44. What can have constituted the cause of death? Not the spear in his side, for the fourth gospel maintains that Jesus was already dead when this wound was inflicted on him, John 19:33. There is only one explanation, a combination of exhaustion, fatigue, general debilitation, and the trauma of the scourging. But not even these factors should have proved fatal so soon. It is possible, of course, that they did, despite the law of physiology. A man will sometimes die from a single relatively innocuous blow. But there would still seem to be something suspicious about the affair. According to the fourth gospel, Jesus' executioners are on the verge of breaking his legs, thus accelerating his death. Why bother if he was already moribund? There would, in short, be no point in breaking Jesus' legs unless death were not, in fact, imminent. In the Gospels, Jesus' death occurs at a moment that is almost too convenient, too feliciously opportune. It occurs just in time to prevent his executioners breaking his legs. And by doing so, it permits him to fulfill an Old Testament prophecy. Modern authorities agree that Jesus, quite unabashedly, modeled and perhaps contrived his life in accordance with such prophecies which heralded the coming of the Messiah. It was for this reason that an ass had to be procured from Bethany on which he could make his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. And the details of the crucifixion seemed likewise engineered to enact the prophecies of the Old Testament. In short, Jesus' apparent and opportune demise, which in the nick of time saves him from certain death and enables him to fulfill a prophecy, is to say the least, suspect. It is too perfect, too precise to be coincidence. It must either be a later interpolation after the fact, or part of a carefully contrived plan. There is much additional evidence to suggest the latter. In the fourth gospel, Jesus, hanging on the cross, declares that he thirsts. So in reply to this complaint, he is proffered a sponge allegedly soaked in vinegar, an incident that also occurs in the other gospels. Now this sponge is generally interpreted as an act of sadistic derision. 1 second, I gotta take a drink. No vinegar there. Let me continue. The sponge is generally interpreted as another act of sadistic derision. But was it really? Vinegar, or soured wine, is a temporary stimulant with effects not unlike smelling salts. It was often used at the time to resuscitate flagging slaves on galleys. For a wounded and exhausted man, a sniff or taste of vinegar would induce a restorative effect, a momentary surge of energy. And yet in Jesus' case, the effect is the contrary. No sooner does he inhale or taste the sponge than he pronounces his final words and, in quote, gives up his ghost. Such a reaction to vinegar is physiologically inexplicable. On the other hand, such a reaction would be perfectly compatible with a sponge soaked not in vinegar, but some type of soporific drug, a compound of opium and or belladonna, for instance, commonly employed in the Middle East at the time. But why offer a soporific drug, unless the act of doing so, along with all the other components of the crucifixion, were elements of a complex and ingenious stratagem, a stratagem designed to produce a semblance of death when the victim, in fact, was still alive. Such a strategy would not only have saved Jesus' life, but have also realized the Old Testament prophecies of a Messiah. There are other anomalous aspects of the crucifixion which point to precisely such a stratagem. According to the Gospels, Jesus is crucified at a place called Golgotha, the place of the skull. Later tradition attempts to identify Golgotha as a barren, more or less skull-shaped hill to the northwest of Jerusalem. And yet the Gospels themselves make it clear that the site of the crucifixion is very different from a barren, skull-shaped hill. The fourth Gospel is most explicit on the matter. Now, this is a quote from John 19:41. Now, in the place where he was crucified, there was a garden, and in the garden a new sepulcher, wherein never a man yet laid. Now, Jesus then was crucified not on a barren, skull-shaped hill, nor for that matter in any public place of execution. He was crucified in, or immediately adjacent, to a garden containing a private tomb. According to Matthew 27:60, this tomb and garden were the personal property of Joseph of Arimathea, who according to all four Gospels was both a man of wealth and a secret disciple of Jesus. Popular traditions depict the crucifixion as a large-scale public affair, accessible to the multitudes and attended by a cast of thousands. And yet the Gospels themselves suggest very different circumstances. According to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, the crucifixion is witnessed by most people, including the women from, as it says in Luke 23:49, from afar off. It would thus seem clear that Jesus' death was not a public event, but a private one. A private crucifixion performed on private property. A number of modern scholars argue that the actual site was probably the Garden of Gethsemane. If Gethsemane were indeed the private land of one of Jesus' secret disciples, this would explain why Jesus, prior to the crucifixion, could make such free use of the place. Needless to say, a private crucifixion on private property leaves considerable room for a hoax, a mock crucifixion, a skillfully staged, managed ritual. There would have only been a few eyewitnesses immediately present. To the general populace, the drama would have only been visible, as the synoptic gospels confirm, from some distance. And from such a distance, it would not have been apparent who in fact is being crucified, or if he was actually dead. Such a charade would, of course, have necessitated some connivance and collusion on the part of Pontius Pilate, or of someone influential in the Roman administration. And indeed, such connivance and collusion is highly probable. Hold on. In text here, somebody's asking a question. They wouldn't have used nails then, only tied him. Well, if indeed this was done from a distance, it could make it appear as if there were nails, when indeed ropes were used, or vice versa. All right? So ultimately, if this scenario here is indeed true, then literally you can make anything look any which way you want. And it's the point here that I think is making very clear with, if you will, proof from the Christian Bible. If this was truly at a distance, then indeed, you know, from a distance anything can make it look any which way you want. Remember, in those days, you didn't have orbiting drones, you didn't have binoculars or anything of the kind. If he was literally hundreds of yards away, which could have been a quarter mile or more away, it's only so much that you can see. So this is actually very, very suspicious, and we're going to read on as we continue here. But ultimately, I mean, a point that's made very clear from the gospel stories is Yeshu was not executed in the place where normal criminals were executed. In modern times, for example, when we carry out a state-sponsored execution, it's done, as you know, at a state or federal prison. You wouldn't take the guy in the middle of a park, or better yet, onto private property and execute him there, you know, at a distance. That reeks of suspicion. That's exactly what our authors here are discussing. So, on that note, let me get back to our text again. Such a charade would, of course, have necessitated some connivance and collusion on the part of Pontius Pilate, or of someone influential in the Roman administration. And indeed, such connivance and collusion is highly probable. Granted, Pilate was a cruel and tyrannical man, but he was also corrupt and susceptible to bribes. The historical Pilate, as opposed to the one depicted in the Gospels, would not have been above sparing Jesus' life in exchange for a sizable sum of money and perhaps a guarantee of no further political agitation. Whatever his motivation, there is in any case no question that Pilate is somehow intimately involved in this affair. He acknowledges Jesus' claim as, in quote, King of the Jews, and he also expresses, or feigns to express, surprise that Jesus' death occurs as quickly as it apparently does. And perhaps more important of all, he grants Jesus' body to Joseph of Arimathea. According to Roman law at the time, a crucified man was denied all burial. Indeed, guards were customarily posted to prevent relatives or friends removing the bodies of the dead. The victim would simply be left on the cross at the mercy of the elements and carrion birds. Yet Pilate, in a flagrant breach of procedure, readily grants Jesus' body to Joseph of Arimathea. This clearly attests to some complicity on Pilate's part, and it may attest to other things as well. In English translations of Mark's Gospel, Joseph asks Pilate for Jesus' body. Pilate expresses surprise that Jesus is dead, checks with the centurion, then, satisfied, consents to Joseph's request. Now, this would appear straightforward enough at first glance, but in the original Greek version of Mark's Gospel, the matter becomes rather more complicated. In the Greek version, when Joseph asks for Jesus' body, he uses the word soma, a word applied only to a living body. Pilate, assenting to the request, employs the word patoma, which means corpse. According to the Greek, then, Joseph explicitly asks for a living body, and Pilate grants him what he thinks, or pretends to think, is a dead one. Now, given the prohibition against burying crucified men, it is also extraordinary that Joseph receives any body at all. On what grounds did he receive it? What claims does he have to Jesus' body? If he was a secret disciple, he could hardly plead any claim without disclosing his secret relationship, unless Pilate was already aware of it, or unless there was some other factor involved which militated in Joseph's favor. There is little information about Joseph of Arimathea. The Gospels report only that he was a secret disciple of Jesus, possessed great wealth, and belonged to the Sanhedrin, the Council of Elders which ruled Judea community of Jerusalem under Roman auspices. It would thus seem apparent that Joseph was an influential man. And this conclusion receives confirmation from his dealings with Pilate and from the fact that he possesses a tract of land with a private tomb. It's all very, very curious, isn't it? Okay? So, continuing here, it says, if this were indeed the case, it would at least have furnished him with some plausible claim to Jesus' body. Here, let me read this here. This is getting into the Holy Blood, Holy Grail's ideas of things. Medieval tradition portrays Joseph of Arimathea as a custodian of the Holy Grail, and Percival is said to be of his lineage. According to other later traditions, he is in some way related by blood to Jesus and Jesus' family. Now, if this indeed were the case, it would at very least have furnished him with some plausible claim to Jesus' body. For while Pilate would hardly grant the corpse of an executed criminal to a random stranger, he might well do so with the incentive of a bribe to the dead man's kin. And if Joseph, a wealthy and influential member of the Sanhedrin, was indeed Jesus' kin, he bears further testimony to Jesus' Aristotic pedigree. And if he were Jesus' kin, his association with the Holy Grail, the blood of Royale, would of course be all the more explicable. End of quote here from Holy Blood, Holy Grail. So, this is the interesting things that we have to deal with here. Who's Joseph of Arimathea? How did he get involved in the story? What's he doing here? How did he get anything happening? So you see, I believe the Holy Blood and Holy Grail opens up a good number of what we can call cans of worms here, as we say, that create for us many, many questions that we have to ask. And now that you have an insight into my understanding, where I'm coming from, I want to get back and read the text again from my Orthodox point of view. And based upon these insights, augment them, add to them, as we shall see. We are in chapter 27 of Matthew, verse 27. We already went through the issue of the trial, the whitewashing of Pilate's involvement in it, the release of this person, Barabbas. We went through that whole thing in our previous lessons. And now, it says that Yeshu was handed over to the soldiers of the governor. They took Yeshu into a common hall, gathered unto him a whole band of soldiers. They stripped him and put on him a scarlet robe. And when they had planted a crown of thorns, they put it upon his head. and a reed in his right hand, and they bowed the knee before him, mocked him, saying, "Hail, King of the Jews." And they spit on him, and took the reed, and smote him on his head. And after that they mocked him, they took the robe off from him, and put his own raiments on him, and led him away to crucify him. Now, accordingly, as we just read, Roman law was to beat the person intentionally to weaken them for the crucifixion. But I must have missed the point in Roman law where they intentionally would make crowns of thorns and mock him. Why was this done? And the answer should be very clear. It was because of the anti-Semitism that existed in the Roman administration. It is no different as if this were done in the 20th century by Nazis, or before them by Russian Cossacks, or before them by Christian inquisitors or Christian crusaders. That is the way it has always been. A violent prejudice and hatred of Jews. So you see, Yeshu here was the subject of anti-Semitism. If you remember, we discussed in our previous class the famous chapter in Isaiah, chapter 53, about the suffering servant. Here, Yeshu is suffering. Why? It didn't say, "This is Yeshu, let's pick on him." Rather, it says, "This is the King of the Jews." Yeshu, who is supposedly a insurrection guy against the Roman government, wanting to take over, therefore they mocked him as such. Today, in the Islamic world, major controversy that you have groups led by an individual who calls himself the new caliph, the new representative of the Prophet, who wants to declare himself the new leader of the Islamic Empire. Needless to say, most of Islam does not recognize him. And what do you think they would do to him if and when they would topple him? Well, this is pretty much what the Romans did to Yeshu. Hatred goes a long way. They intentionally mocked him, just like they often mocked many Jews. Now remember something. Crucifixion was a common form of punishment for the Romans to inflict on Jews. Thousands of Jews died of crucifixion. The cross, that's even echoed in Yeshu's teachings, was a sign of Jewish martyrdom long before it became a sign of Christian salvation. And this explains why they took pleasure in mocking him and beating him. So again, like I mentioned in the previous class, when you see portrayals of what is called the Passion of Christ, wherein which Yeshu is being beaten, and Christians will turn to non-Christians, Jews specifically, and say, "Don't you feel anything?" The proper response is, "Yes, we definitely do. But we don't feel the suffering of just an individual. We feel the suffering of all of them. We feel the suffering of those who were mocked and crucified by the Romans, those who were burned and slaughtered by the Crusaders, those who were raped and pillaged by the Cossacks, those who were murdered, tortured, and shot and gassed by the Nazis. All of them. Throughout the ages, throughout the centuries, this is the same." And I might add, curiously enough, if we want to throw in the idea and concept of reincarnation, if Yeshu were ever to have come back in the days of the Crusades, in the days of the Cossacks, in the days of the Nazis, he would have been marched in and killed along with all the other Jews of the day. So I believe this is important for us to know and to understand that the Passion of Christ is actually the anti-Semitic torture of a Jew. And that is something that people have to take into account. There are those Christian extremists today who call upon the Jews and say, you Jews have to give an accounting for the deicide, the death of God. We in turn respond, not necessarily. But you extremist Christians have to give account for the hatred you have that put Yeshua on the cross. You have to give account for the hatred you have towards God's human beings that God created. Your fellow religionists, whether you like it or not, the Jewish people. And that is a big burden that world Christianity truly has to address. And indeed, part of my purpose in giving this course is to try to address these issues in the Christian community. Because ultimately, true and sincere Christians, true and sincere Jews, we're all part of the greater family. Yes, that is actually a concept of all people expounded by Paul. And we'll get to Paul and Romans when we do later in this series, you know, when we get into later courses. But this is not something unknown in Judaism today. We always seek to embrace those who embrace the universal laws. And there are many Christians, millions of them, who do around the world from every denomination and every which way, who are not plagued with the evil spirit, the demonic element of anti-Semitism. No, not all Romans were anti-Semitic. Pilate was a corrupt man. The Romans who mocked him were clearly anti-Semites. Today, we have all the kinds. We have the corrupt kind, we have the anti-Semitic kind, and we have the good kind. Let's build bridges, because that is the right thing to do. And on that note, let's get back out of my moralisms here into our text. It says here in verse 32, as they came out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. Him they compelled to bear the cross. Now, if you remember, I just read to you moments ago from the second century ideas and beliefs of Basilides of this guy Cyrene, Simon of Cyrene. They said that Yeshu did a bait and switch. According to the story, Yeshu struggled with the cross. He couldn't handle it. So they grabbed Simon and said, you carry it for him. Now, according to Basilides, Yeshu was a, what he says here, an incorporeal power. And therefore he did a shape shift. And therefore transformed himself and made Simon to look like Yeshu and Yeshu to look like Simon. Okay, that's all a very nice supernatural little rendition of things. True, false, is we're not in the true, false business here. We're just in the business of trying to address issues. Now, here's the issue. What really happened? Again, he's being taken. And it says here, when they came unto a place called Golgotha, that is to say, a place of the skull. Why did they say that? What is this place of the skull? If you remember what we just read in Holy Blood, Holy Grail, this was not the place where in which traditional Roman executions were carried out. Indeed, you can read in Josephus and other historical records of the time which exist to this day. They used to crucify people by the hundreds, sometimes thousands. They used to line the roads with them. Very gruesome and ugly sight. And yet, Yeshu is brought here to Golgotha. And as it was recorded in the other Gospels, they said there's a garden there and there's a tomb right there. Really? In old Roman times, would you have had, if you were a citizen, a tomb, your private tomb, in the place of execution? Ew, that's kind of gross. No. You'd have had it in a very different place. Kind of like in a garden. So what's the execution being done there? Very, very strange stuff is the Holy Blood, Holy Grail from Joyce brings down. It says here, they gave him vinegar to drink mingled with gall, and when he tasted thereof, he would not drink. If you remember, we also went into that issue. Why wouldn't he drink of it? What would be the human purpose behind that? Don't know. Moving on. So it says, and they crucified him. They parted his garments, casting lots, that it might be fulfilled that which was spoken by the prophet. They parted my garments among them, and my vestures did they cast lots. Now, again, that might be one of those, shall we say, after the fact prophecies. If you go back and look at the original words when that was originally spoken in Psalm 22, it doesn't really say that. So, that's a funny thing about prophecy. You can make anything after the fact appear to be a prophecy, when in all due respect, it might not have been. But okay, it sounds good for our story. Now remember, the original Matthew, the real guy, like Yeshu before him, as has been echoed in the words of the books that we've been reading, clearly had an agenda to make Yeshu look messianic by constructing and orchestrating his deeds to make sure it appeared messianic in fulfillment of prophecy. So therefore, any which way or anything that could be was done to make that accomplished. Why? Because you wanted to make sure you had the rank and file, the everyday people on your side. And remember, Yeshu was very popular in his time, with the intent that indeed he would have the army behind him to start an insurrection. And again, as we know, if indeed this happened as is believed in around the year 30 of the Common Era, it was only 30 to 40 years later that indeed the second generation, or some even say Yeshu, an older man himself, did succeed in leading the insurrection against Rome, creating the civil war which led to the destruction of Jerusalem. Okay, we'll discuss more of that as we move on. So, sitting down, the guards did, they were watching him up there, and they set over his sign an accusation, saying, "This is Yeshu, the King of the Jews." Why would they put up a sign like that? From what I read in the other gospel, they put it in three different languages. Why? Did they believe that he was the King of the Jews? Or was this further mocking and insult that they would be able to say to all Jews passing by, "This is what we do to your, the best of you"? Obviously, we would do the same to you. Needless to say, this is another anti-Semitic mocking insult and has to be looked at in that light. Verse 38 says that there were two thieves crucified with him, one on his right hand and one on his left. Now, it is interesting that in quote the word thieves, what is a thief? Thief's a guy who steals, right? When in Roman law is someone executed, especially by crucifixion, for the crime of theft? It did not exist, it did not happen. The original Greek word was not thief, or should not be translated as thief. The original word, I forgot what the original Greek word was, but it meant what we would call a terrorist, an insurrectionist, a zealot, a brigand, a violent criminal. That's someone who stole. Indeed, more indication that Yeshu here is being executed for the crime of insurrection against Rome. Someone in text was asking, what law did Yeshu violate in Judaism? Well, I think you would be hard-pressed by looking at the Christian story to find it. In Talmudic polemics, there are all kinds of stories told about Yeshu. However, like I read in our introduction, polemics are not necessarily historically accurate, nor are they meant to be. So, I don't see necessarily any real crime that Yeshu committed against the religion of Judaism, which would have necessitated his execution. One can easily, to this very day, review the laws of capital punishment in Judaism and ask, well, which did he did? Or is the punishment, is idolatry a capital crime? Yes, but what idolatry did Yeshu actually commit? None. Did he call himself, I am God, worship me? Well, if he worshipped himself, worshipping for a false god is what is idolatrous. But those are later Christian interpolations, not the original historical Yeshu. So Yeshu is here mocked. He is put together with two other violent criminals, clearly indicative of the original Greek as being zealots. And it says, and they that passed by reviled him, wagging their heads, and saying, thou that destroyest the temple and build it in 3 days, save thyself if thou beest the Son of God, come down from the cross. Wait a second. Did he really say that he could build a temple in 3 days? Was this some kind of symbolic talk? Who are these people who are coming by the cross? And would they have said, if you be the Son of God, come down from the cross? In my King James Version, they have Son of God in caps here. That story here, to me, is very suspicious. Because, again, nowhere do we find anywhere anybody calling Yeshu the Son of God in some kind of divine way as Catholic theology would ascribe. So therefore, I question this. If indeed he was at a distance, it's not like they would have been at the foot of the cross looking up at him, but maybe literally a quarter mile away pointing and saying to anybody who might have been paying attention, which might not have been many, right? All right, look at him. There he is. They got him up there in a cross. All right, let's see what happens to his messianic stuff now. Likewise, also the chief priests, mocking him with the scribes and the elders, said, he saved others, and he cannot save. Right? Himself he cannot save. If he be the king of Israel, let him come now down from the cross, and we will believe him. He trusted in God, let him deliver now. And if he will have him, for he said, I am the Son of God. Really? Listen to this. Well, if he is the king of Israel, let him come down. He trusted in God, let God now deliver him. All right, if he says, I am the Son of God, here we go again with this Son of God stuff. We don't find Yeshu really saying that. Here again we have, in my opinion, an anti-Semitic embellishment to the story with the specific intent to make the Jewish people in general look bad. How funny that when telling a story of anti-Semitism, we are reading an account of it that has been edited and brought to us by anti-Semites who try to make the anti-Semitic Romans look not anti-Semitic, at the same time making the Jews look bad and therefore exposing their own anti-Semitism. What a queer, twisted way of things. The anti-Semites are telling the story of anti-Semitism. You know what it reminds me of? It reminds me today of Holocaust denial. The anti-Semites today want to say, the Germans never killed 6 million Jews in Germany. There was no Holocaust. And because the Jews made up this terrible, horrible lie, we should kill them all. They actually declare the Holocaust to be a lie and then want to use the excuse of the lie of the Holocaust to commit a Holocaust. Do you recognize this queer and twisted hatred? You see that same kind of principle here. In modern day discussion, as it was written here in the gospel account. And now it states, the thieves which were crucified with him cast the same in his teeth. In other words, there are those who, one of them was with him, one was against him, etc. and so on. Alrighty. Now, you know what? It says here at the sixth hour, darkness all over the land into the ninth hour. And the ninth hour, it says, he cried out and said, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani. We should go back into the original Aramaic in Psalm 22 and read what he says. But I'm going to tell you this. I want to stop here and pick up on this topic in our next class, because I want to cover the entire concept of the death and the myths of what happened at the death, but I don't have time to get into it this moment, and then get into the burial, the resurrection, and the story. And if we have time in our next class, if not, then the one after that, we have to get into the great concept of the Trinity and where it all came from and how it's grown from something and everything else. But alrighty, we're going to conclude here in verse 45. I know we did not cover much in the text, but we laid the premise of the ideas and concepts of what we need, and I think that's important for us as we proceed into the text. So, obviously I'll read ahead, but it's important that we do scholarly research to try to understand the difference between what we can call polemic history and story. Now, of course, from a Christian point of view, every word is in, quote, gospel truth. But from a scholarly point of view, we recognize that may just not be so. Either way, our job as students is to learn, to be exposed to different ideas, to be exposed to the different interpretations, the different ideas and beliefs from ancient times to modern times. Take it for how you will. I just pray that knowledge should inspire you to be good and a better human being as opposed to something less. So on that note, let's conclude tonight. Thank you again all for joining me. I'm your host, Ariel Bartzadok. Come see me online at koshertorah.com. God bless. Good night. Shalom.